and all this type of thing. So one day while I was watching this, I saw that the girl had made a very nice house with a little roof and chimney and everything, all of wet sand. So I said, too bad that isn't going to last very long. And she looked up, she was about 5 years old. She says, it doesn't make any difference. Nothing we build here will last very long. She was about a full 20 or 30 incarnations ahead of her parents. This is the way it was. She was waking up to something, which other people have a long time getting around to. But it's not a bad idea for the child heart, regardless of physical age, to realize that in a way life is very much like a sandbox. Here in this little mass of sand, we build everything you can think of. We build empires, we put little tin soldiers and have battles, we put little animals and have pastures and farms, and in the sandbox we build all kinds of archetypal patterns. And I think it's too bad that children don't have more sandboxes, because I think it would do them more good than psychoanalysis in many cases. Because it would show what they're thinking about, what they're feeling, and how they're trying to express it. But life, to all of us, whether we know it or not, is not very different from a sandbox. It can be very elaborate, but at the present time the sandbox is there, but because of the smog we can hardly see the box, let alone do anything important with it. But the sandbox is very important because it is the miniature of the universe. We are all playing in sandboxes. And we are all also largely playing in the same sandbox, which is a little larger. And as each person comes along, the first thing he does is tear down the previous work in the sandbox and put his own in its place. This is commonly known as progress. But it is just simply that the individual is daydreaming. He is imagining the things that he thinks would help. But in the long analysis, the small child is the one who realizes that it's all in a sandbox. It has not yet been overwhelmed, over-influenced to the degree that it assumes that the things that are built in the sandbox are frightfully important and are going to change the course of history. The only way they will change the course of history is when someone else comes along to play in the same sandbox and tears down the original design. This is history. And this is the type of world we've lived in because somewhere along the line we just forgot that we are doing these things. We have grown up to the point where we really take ourselves seriously. Each generation takes itself seriously. Each individual becomes deeply concerned, not with his integrities, but with the passing shadows which he casts upon society. We are all in the same fix. But the child that Mencius mentions is the child with the child heart, regardless of age. A child heart that in all things simply sees reality. Just simply sees the thing as it is. Because it has not yet developed the prejudices and conceits and deceits by means of which the child heart is destroyed. Now, with the child heart, the world comes into the mystical, but also the idealistic range of possibilities. We can say, therefore, that if we have lost it due to troubles or sometimes just simply due to success, which is a very destructive thing in many cases, we have to get it again. Now, mysticism, as it practiced both in the West and in the East, is very lightly and largely an effort to restore the child heart. Before we can find out what's inside of ourselves, we have to escape from the dynamic pressure of our own mental attitudes. We have to get over the idea that the things that are making us unhappy every day are inevitable, that they are part of a universal plan we can do nothing about. We have to realize that we are responsible for our animosities, for our antagonisms, and our exploitations. And until these cease, there is going to be nothing but misery. So with the search for the child heart, most people, somewhere along the line, remember the fact that once they were 5 years old, and at that time, the world looked pretty good. For most people, the world looked like infinite opportunity. And now, 40, 50 years later, the world looks like infinite discomfort. That everything is not the way it should be, that we are constantly struggling after false goals, and that out of all of this tremendous struggle we have made to build mountains in our sandboxes, we are broken-hearted, disillusioned, and enfeebled by the lack of internal courage and resource. So, maybe at 40, 50 years of old, we must go back after that child heart. We must become children again if we are to be part of the kingdom of heaven. We have to be what might be termed an archetypal child, the kind of child that has all that is good in childish mannerism, that has all of the beauties and the integrities and the attractiveness of the small child. We have to realize that even though we are living in a sophisticated world, our own way of life is still very childish, that we are actually crawling around trying to find out how to walk, let alone how to do all the wonderful things we think we can do. Actually, then, getting rid of sophistication is no more or less than getting rid of what we have called maturity. Now, everybody thinks maturity is a wonderful thing. Well, maturity has a lot of advantages, including 10% off on certain products that you buy. But maturity is not that. Maturity is the individual ability to outgrow his own mistakes. Maturity is the person who has awakened to the reality. He is the person who has discovered the real dimensions of the sandbox. He is the one who has realized that if there is no reason for existence other than that which he has experienced in his own daily living, then the whole plan is rather impoverished. But that he may have had wonderful experiences and failed to benefit from them is only a proof that sophistication has destroyed his own integrity. So coming to the realization he's got to get back, probably, not only through the childhood of this life, but maybe the childhood of 100 lives, to find out what the realities are. He must begin to dig inside himself, for somewhere in the depths of his own nature is the record of all he has been, all he has done, all he has hoped for. Now, it may not be available to him in form of incidents, which is just as well. Very few people could sustain a detailed biography of their own previous embodiments. It would indicate too much misery and sorrow due to personal mistakes. But there comes forward a kind of balance sheet in which the person has certain general attitudes about the things he has gone through. He has realized that certain processes of the past gave him great pain. On the other hand, certain nice experiences or beautiful occasions, they come down to him as credits and assets and something to enrich faith and hope and charity. So we start out to get back to the child center within ourselves. And that child center is simply the incarnating self in us, the thing that lives from generation to generation, from age to age. And there is the oversoul of Emerson, that mysterious power by which we can be inwardly guided and taught rather than depending upon a scholastic system which has no interest in the eternal life of the individual, only in his buying and selling power over a few years. So to get back into this again, we have to do what the child has to do, and which most children should be taught to do, but they are not. And that is to spend some time quietly with themselves. Every child should have periods of peace which are important to it. It should be able to retire for a little while and simply remember in a mysterious, general way the eternity to which it belongs. This is very important to small children. But today it is gradually being crowded out, and every available moment is spent in front of a television. All this is not good. And the older person, who is beginning to realize that it isn't good, must begin to dig inside of himself to get back the simplicity of the divine. Jesus, in his preachings, seldom used words of over one syllable, sometimes two syllables. Nearly all of the great teachers have taught very simply. They have taught realities. They have taught compassion, friendship, kindness. They have taught those graces which go from life to a life, not graces which are no longer any good when we leave here. When we devote everything we have to adjustment here, and forget entirely to adjust with the infinite which we always belong to and always will belong to, life does not go well. So mysticism steps in to help us to regain the child core within ourselves. And it begins by finding the same appreciations that children believe. The bed of flowers, the forest, the trees, a little pet, all of these things help to restore in us a sympathy for life, a recognition of the sublimity of something around us, and how something within us is crying out to protect those beauties around us. And that's why we feel a little sad when another forest is cut down to make way for condominiums. Something is lost. Something is taken away. We say it is necessary. Well, if we have to lose the land on the outside for the condominium, it is more important still that we plow the inner life and keep the garden there growing in good health. We have to build into the internal and the invisible most of the projects which are going to endure. We have to build more and more upon things unseen rather than storing up our treasures at 11%. We need a great deal more insight. We have to have material things. No one denies it. But we also have to have time and place for those things which belong to God, those things which belong to the Spirit within us. And as we get nearer and nearer to the realization of the divine, we seem to grow younger. And very soon, as we approach the divine, we are small children again. We are children in the face of God, just as we are adults in the face of each other. The divine in us is forever seeking the parental principle of life, the principle which loves all things, serves all things, sacrifices for all things, and intends beyond all doubt to bring life together into the final fulfillment of the divine hope. These things we have to work with, so we'd set aside a little time for eternity in this world of confusion and stress. And we don't do that by thinking about nothing. We do it rather by trying to understand the common sense and the things that happen to us. Learn to understand values and the lesson we should learn rather than the incident that we would regret. Many people would like to forget the most valuable experiences of their lives. That is not the answer. Nature will not let us forget those valued experiences, and if we don't pay attention to them here, they'll catch up to us later. The moment a valuable experience occurs, no matter how uncomfortable it may be, it is absolutely necessary to examine it, to consider it, and to transmute it from a misfortune to a spiritual asset. We have to correct our own mistakes by facing them. And if we face our mistakes and correct them, then they cease to exist. In quietude of mysticism, the individual, therefore, lives to simplify, even as in his outer life he lives to complicate. Everything that is real is essentially simple. And that is why the child heart can take it, and why it comes from the child heart. Because the child can be best approached in simple words and simple thoughts. And it is the same with the mature of age. the older child, the child in their 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, they can also be best understood and can understand best in simple thoughts and simple terms. Each person can simplify the complications of his own life until he finally realizes that he lived all these years with truth locked within himself, which he was not able to use because he had put a barrier of intellectualism between himself and truth. The child hasn't done this. The child is open. After troubles come along, we begin to shut up. We close off experience. We build walls against it. We fight to protect the status quo. We do not want to change. We fear growth or progress. And therefore, we lock ourselves in our misfortune. The small child, living in wonder, can explore and understand things that are beyond our comprehension. But the small child in us can awaken again and understand them. So we watch little by little to see what happens. And we observe that in this day there are a great many intellectual activities. There are all kinds of people doing all kinds of things, many of them interesting and useful. But there is also a vast conflict of individuals who, while all interested in the common good, are unable to even be reasonably pleasant in the presence of each other. All the way along, attitudes become the basis of barriers. Our thoughts become the barriers of somebody else's thoughts. Here we go back to the sandbox. We have built something in that box that to us is just wonderful. So when our back is turned, or when the time comes for us to leave sandboxes, someone else comes along behind us, tears down what we have done, and proceeds to build something else. Or if we're not lucky, they may try to do it while we're still building ours. But in any event, comes a great conflict. A conflict of objectives. A conflict of projects that we have. As we get deeper and deeper into life, these conflicts fade away. Well, the mystics and many of the great idealistic teachers of humanity have realized that the nearer we come to reality, all of us, the more similar our beliefs become. And that when we attain reality, we will all have the same belief, not imposed upon us, but discovered by us in the process of our own growth. So the child heart isn't much interested in sectarianism or in political structures. It is seeking forever faith, truth, love, understanding. It wants to laugh and not just to cry. It wants to be close to something, not separated from it by all kinds of artificial barriers. It wants that little kitten or the little puppy dog that it can pour out its soul to. These are the things of the child heart. And as we grow older, these unfold into the great virtues of life. These are the things that gradually become tremendous, so important, that when the time finally comes, we can go to sleep in these things and wake in another life. Everything should be a gentle experience of values. Now, this may seem almost impossible in a world such as we live in. Fortunately, all of these are internal projects. And internal projects do not have any serious repercussions upon our daily life. We do not need to make enemies in order to grow. We do not need to defy other people in order to put our ideas across. Because these things are not important anyway. All of this is nothing but the castle in the sandbox. What we really should do and must do, if we're going to rescue ourselves, is simply to know the art of being kind, to know the gentleness by which we can live with other people, allow them to live their lives as best they can, try to understand them, and whenever the need arises, be courteous and affectionate with them. Actually, to recognize in a mysterious way that we are all in the same dilemma, that some people feel that they have solved the dilemma and others do not. And very few agree as to what the solution is. But one thing we all agree on, and that we have a dilemma. We have an unsettled and uncertain future, a difficult present time to face life. Therefore, we have a common cause. And for this common cause, we must give greater emphasis and may have less pressure upon the different separate solutions which we attempt to apply. If we become very quiet inside ourselves, the answer will come. And the answer always comes from the inside. And the answer comes because in the quietude of ourselves, we break through the artificial accumulations of the mind and get back to that root which is dark and mysterious within us. All of our great problems, practically all of them, are mind-oriented. With the mind, we build all our philosophies, all our political systems, all our economic and scientific achievements. We also build the social mores of our time. It is the mind that tells us how we should live. The mind telling us who we should like and who we should dislike. The mind forever dominating the things that we do, but the mind itself essentially unreliable. The mind is too much objectified by prejudice. In the mind, that intolerance of a lifetime are stored carefully. Unfortunate memories are kept on file. And everything that has conditioned us adversely is gradually changing our behavior and making us victims of our own mistakes. The mind is the slayer of the real. Therefore, in trying to solve our world problems, there is no use of piling one mental attitude on another. The solution is not in the world, but in the hearts of men. The solution is not in the grand reformations and revolutions that have led only to further bloodshed since the beginning of time. The answer lies in the gradual release of soul power, the power of the inner life over conduct. We have to have what Gandhi called the victory of soul power over brute power. We also have to have the victory of soul understanding and insight over the complex of varying intellectual policies and beliefs. So if we can get quiet, we can unload part of the burden that never was any good anyway. Get rid of memories that only haunt us. Now, you can't forget them by saying you should. The only way you can forget them is to outgrow them, to solve them, to take that unpleasant bitterness that you had 25 years ago and which you have never been able to solve. Sit down quietly with it and get over it. Get over it by proving beyond all question of doubt that it was an opportunity to grow, that there was something about it that you had to learn, and that the purpose of the experience was that you should transmute an incident into soul growth. And if you have done that, you have no longer any problem, and you can even be thankful for the person who has offended you, if it has helped you to grow. But if it does not help you to grow, it will embitter and canker you from that time on. And the mind will not get over this alone. We can sweep the mind's house out periodically. We can refurbish it. We can move it onto a better ground and all this type. But this is not the answer. It is the power of that which is above the mind, and to which the mind must give allegiance if that power is active. But if that power in ourselves is not active, if we do nothing about it, then the mind becomes the dictator. And as an audacious prime minister takes over control, then we have trouble. And mostly people have allowed this to happen. The mind has become the basis of a character, of a policy, or of a way of life, or of a religion, or anything you wish to call it. But in the last analysis, the mind is a tyrant. It helps us to remain just as foolish as we were, or else helps us sometimes to multiply foolishness, to get worse than we were before. And in interpreting things, the mind always interprets in favor of our own attitude and opinion, and gladly sacrifices the rights of others to even think in order to protect our right to make our own mistakes. so that the mind is not reliable. But beyond and behind the mind is something that we may say is a life in itself. And in the New Testament, we are told of the golden wedding garment which the bridegroom wears when they come to the bride to the wedding of the Lamb. In the book of Revelation and some other parts of the Bible, we hear about the wedding. And this wedding is the church, according to Christian tradition, united in wedding, in marriage to the Lamb of God. Actually, this mysterious hermetic wedding, perhaps the wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, is the union of the personal as the bride of the eternal. All we are as persons, as individuals, as separate beings, we bring to the altar of the eternal. The soul is actually the power to control and direct and enlighten and redeem life. So the golden wedding garment is the soul garment woven from the beauties and integrities of character which we possess. This garment is woven of love, and every time we are able to change indifference to love, there is a new strand in this seamless robe. Every time we forgive an enemy, there is another bit of material added. Little by little, this garment gradually transforms our life. We become robed in the values of righteousness. We behold more clearly the beautiful values of life which we have sacrificed to selfishness. Now we may say, this might cause trouble to do all these things. How are we going to make a living? It doesn't do one thing to prevent anyone from making a living. The mysteries of the Spirit are internal and eternal. And the only thing that we have to do on the outer world is be just a little more honorable in our conduct. And little by little, the things that we believe will become more important. We are here only a little while, and the only thing we can take with us is this marvelous and wondrous soul experience which we have accumulated through the years of insight and understanding. Therefore, if you can begin to shake off or get rid of the ballast of negative thinking, destructive attitudes, and corrupt allegiances, you will find gradually that the simple things of life will come through. Kindness will take hold. In the Buddhist doctrine, the next Buddha, according to them, is the Lord Maitreya, who is waiting in the Tushita heaven to come to earth after a certain period of time. And all these Buddhas are metaphysical Buddhas, so-called. They are not persons. They never were. They are embodiments or personifications of qualities. And therefore, it is appropriate that the next great Buddha to come should be the Lord Maitreya. For in Sanskrit, the word Maitreya means kindness. Therefore, it is the coming of the great kindness that restores the child soul. In this great kindness, everyone becomes a child, has no longer the sophisticated attitudes of a false maturity, but in gentleness and kindness restores the golden age. And there is nothing that we can do that is more valuable than to prove that we are taking care of this garden of the world where we have been placed. Up to now, we have been ravishing this garden for centuries, thinking of nothing but our own enrichment and forgetting the fact we can take nothing with us. Of all the tyrants that have ever lived, all have died and taken nothing with them. And therefore, there seems to be no good reason why we should constantly struggle for that which we cannot keep. Could be dishonest, dishonorable, destructive, simply for powers that fade in a very few years. That out of this little embodiment which we know and is our little life in a sandbox, there is really no reason for the terrible destructiveness that we work upon each other. There is no reason for wars and revolutions or these tremendous problems of nitrogen bombs and everything you can think of. These things are simply delusions. They are false values. They never have any real existence. But we do not want to continue to look forward to the fact that we have to die out of this world to find peace. What we should be able to do is live here and make peace real. Find ways in which we can do these things. Now, someone will say it can't be done. Well, maybe it can, maybe it can't. But one thing can be done. In ourselves, we can first establish that peace. We can establish it by returning to the simple acceptances of life which mark the small child. We can be born again, not in the theological sense, but in the sense of a new birth in childlike simplicity. Somewhere along the way, we can have another birth as a child. Again, this birth as a child is a case in which we cast off, not necessarily the body, but cast off the attitudes which have made it impossible for us to grow. Attitudes which have given us nothing but sorrow, selfishness, self-centered, antagonisms of every kind. Attitudes in which we have sacrificed peace and happiness, and as a result have been punished not only by our misery and misfortune, but by sickness and all times of disasters. Why not have the sense of a five-year-old and consciously decide to get rid of these things? To find that anything that hurts needlessly any other creature should be forever out of our systems. That we are not here to blame people. We are here to work with them for common growth. We are not here to compete with them. We are here for the great problem of learning to cooperate together for the survival of man and the glory of God. We are here to live out a plan, not a chaos. We are here to do things that will make a better world. We are not here simply to go on until we pass out of this life. Pass out of the life without any knowledge of why we were born, without any realization of what we should have done. But occasionally there are what William Blake called the good people, who have always by nature lived well, regardless of circumstances. And these people are truly the ones in which, in his engravings, Blake shows the soul of the good person ascending in the keeping of the angels. There is this idea that this good we do cuts away from us most of the troubles and sorrows of life. If we were not opinionated, self-centered, and dogmatic, our lives would be much simpler. And children aren't those things normally because they haven't been educated into them. And the pressures of society working on the mind, and the mind only, have gradually changed many millions of people into small tyrants who found no pleasure or happiness for themselves and give none to others. This type of thing is the result of assuming that we grow up. And by growing up, we become heartless. By growing up, we become disillusioned, cruel, self-centered, arrogant, and live only for a few dollars that will vanish as they always have. The whole point is that we try to use the mind to get the impression that we're growing up. But we're not. We don't grow up because we become more complicated. We grow up because we become less complicated. It's true in politics. Someday in this world, this whole political system has to finally dissolve into the fact that we have one planet with very limited resources, and we better learn to get along together happily. It would be so much easier, save a great deal of wear and tear, and liberate the mind for more constructive thinking. There's no reason why it couldn't happen. And there's no reason why these things can't happen in ourselves. I think Confucius would say they must happen in ourselves first. The first thing we've got to take care of is the rectification of personal character. Then we've got to prove this rectification, this self-improvement, by carrying it into our intimate domestic life. We've got to make this new level of integrities the basis of the home, of our courteous and proper relationships with those to whom we are tied by blood or by bonds. Therefore, that the proof of our redemption, the proof that our childhood is back, as it is that we live quietly, constructively, and become beloved of those who know us, always willing to help, always patient in problems, always unselfish in moments of decision, and always liberal and tolerant of the beliefs of other people. If we can establish homes upon this basis, if more and more people, under the pressure of present circumstances, are realizing that we are disintegrating the foundations of society for no good reason, then we may be able gradually to restore the simple life. Nature sometimes almost does this for us. Many pierced persons, as they grow older, become again a little bit like children. They become more kind, more detached, more gentle, or if they've had a bad conditioning all the way along, they can become impossible. But if they are impossible, they are impossible children. They have brought back all the childish defects, all of the immaturities of life, and they remain in their closing years perfect examples of what to avoid. And the time has come to avoid this type of thing, so that we live in peace and die in peace, that we are born gently and lovingly, that we carry out our daily duties and responsibilities faithfully, that we earn our livelihood by diligence, that we depend only upon our own inner resources for the decisions that give us the courage and the values to live as better people. If we work out these problems a little bit in our own gentle way, we can find a new childhood of humanity. It would be kind of wonderful to find a whole world of nothing but happy children. Well, that world of happy children is here, because each one of us is a happy child who has become miserable by trying to grow up, when actually all we have done is to grow old. You have not grown up, because to grow up means that this child life has got to come through and become one of the great creative and protective forces of our human existence. Then there won't be any more of this constant irritation. We can do it to ourselves, and that's the beginning. This is meditation. This is discipline. This is mysticism. But it is by means of this that that which was of deity in the beginning, like the prodigal son, wanders through the illusions of the lower world and finally returns to his father's house. And we all come back because we are children of one father. We are children of one parent. We are parental offspring, sons and daughters of the infinite. And therefore, we all have the right to be brothers one and sisters one with each other, and children to the eternal parents from which our existence is suspended. In those kind of thinkings, perhaps we can, you know, get back a little of that good-heartedness of childhood that we can remember dimly, but seemingly can no longer maintain as a way of life. Well, that's it, folks.